As I opened the door, I could see that the room had windows because the light made me squint. Yet I knew there were no windows on that side of the house. I stepped inside and gasped. I don't know what I expected, but this was not it. The light came through windows in the ceiling, but that wasn't what took my breath away. It was the bird cages, hundreds of them. There were cages of every size and shape imaginable. Some of them homemade from river cane. Others had been whittled and pieced together. Still others were metal. Each one was unique. I don't know how long I looked at the bird cages. Not one of them had ever housed a bird. Yet they were all lined with clean newspapers. Their trays were filled with food and water. Perches hung in some of them. Others had branches wedged in where large birds could sit. Some of the cages hung from ceiling rafters. Some hung from hooks on the wall, and some sat on tables and shelves. How many hours had my uncle put into constructing this beautiful haven for imaginary birds? How many years of his life were spent carving birds and designing cages? The thought hit me. If I counted the cages in this room and I counted the birds in his bookcase, would they be the same? I promised that one day, when I had more time, I would come do it. I chose a tiny cage for the hummingbird, bolted the door, and left, deciding before I even got past the living room that I would keep his secret for now. He had wanted that room to be his private world. I would not mention it to Cookie or to anyone. After I left his cabin, I went back home and found Uncle Fawcett in front of Bob's shed. When I had left, he had been asleep, but he had unlocked the trailer and let himself out. It was a good thing I came back when I did, or he might have gotten out on the highway and hitched a ride back into town. "Uncle Fawcett," I said, "let's go to town." I set his things on the truck bed. "Don't know who you are," he mumbled. "But I need to go to the stockyards. You heading to the stockyards, are you?" "I am," I said. "I'd be much obliged to give you a ride over there. Come get in my truck." He grunted as he hobbled across the yard on his canes. I kept a wooden block of wood on the back of my truck. I took it off and used it for a step while I held his canes and supported him. Once he was settled, I climbed behind the wheel and we were off. The drive from our farm to Mercy was a long, a narrow two-lane road that snaked among the hewn-out rocky cliffs. I was probably the only woman in the United States who still had an 8-track player in her vehicle, but Bob was absolutely convinced that 8-tracks and vinyls were the only safe ways to listen to music, so he had installed one in my truck because he knew how much I loved music. I had a tape of Dolly playing, and I hummed along to my Tennessee mountain home. When "Daddy Come and Get Me" came on, I thought of my poor uncle being locked away in an institution. I switched tracks and listened to Jolene. As I drove into town, white fog blanketed it. In about half an hour, the sun would burn it away, and the twinkling city lights of dawn would change from magical star eyes peering through fog to dim interiors of stores and small businesses that dotted the valley. I rubbed the sleep from my eyes, wishing for a cup of coffee. Uncle Fawcett slept in the seat beside me, his mouth hanging open, revealing his toothless gum. His deep wrinkles made me think of a newborn all red and crinkled. He would likely never see the town waking up again, but after having spent the past several days with him calling me Violi, I knew his mind was so far gone that he wouldn't remember that he had missed it. I guess that sheriff had been right, and I had to wake up and face reality. My uncle was an ordinary human, after all. Maybe I could always remember him as a smiling tour guide, or as a young man in a photo with some war buddies he had saved. Uncle Fawcett's remaining days would be spent fighting a war that had been over long before I was born, loving an Italian miner's daughter who died in childbirth before electricity came to the hills, and raising a daughter who had now been dead for a long time. I pulled up to the traffic light as I entered the city limits and waited for it to change from red to green. Street lights flickered off, and an open sign lit up in the hardware store beyond the junction. A rectangular white building set on a hillside directly opposite it, overlooking the city like a silent ghost, reminding all that youthful days and active minds would surely pass away. As I drove the long winding drive up the hillside, I fought back tears. I spotted a stone sign that read, Evercare Retirement Center, as I neared the end of the drive and reached the parking lot. I pulled my truck as close to the front entrance as possible and cut the engine. I laid my hand on my passenger's arm. Wake up, Uncle Fawcett. What, Eleonora? I smiled, a sad, sympathetic smile, because my heart broke from his longing for his dead wife. No, Uncle, it's me, Cupcake.
Cupcake, damn fool name, he said.
That's what he told my mother every time she mentioned the way she had named Cookie and me after her favorite sweets in hopes that we would be sweet our whole lives. I wondered if she had known that Cookie would be so easily crumbled, would she have named us differently? I got out and opened my great uncle's truck door. Come on, I said.
Where are we going?
To visit some friends. I waited for him to bring his canes around in front of him, and I held his arm to steady him as he got out. As I closed the door, he looked at me with a blank expression.
You Trudy's girl?
No, I'm your great niece. He nodded. Oh. Trudy had been his little sister. She married a Mormon when she was 18 and moved to Utah. Uncle Fawcett never got over her going, and every Christmas he stood on the porch, looking down the road for Trudy to bring her baby for a visit. One year, Trudy really came, but by the time she did, her baby was 27 years old. They were both killed in a plane crash on their way back to Utah. An orderly met us at the door and escorted us to the lobby desk where I finished filling out the final paperwork and made the first 6 months' payment. Bob was unaware that I had been keeping a savings account for years, and now I was glad that I'd kept it a secret, because it took the entire amount. Cookie assured me that she and Thomas Jeffrey would pay it next time. As far as Bob knew, Cookie was footing the entire bill. But there was no way I could burden my sister like that. I suppose I was a bit deceptive in keeping my personal savings account from Bob. But I had always known that the day would come when somebody in the family would fall sick, and since Bob had no insurance and I had no insurance, this was our only security blanket. He would have had a fit if he had known I had a savings account. That's why I gave them Cookie's address, and all of my secret mail went to her house. I went with the orderly to see Uncle Fawcett's room and help him get his belongings squared away. It took only minutes to get him settled. He asked me who I was 4 times within that time, and repeatedly wanted to know how far he was from Germany and what did I think about Roosevelt's New Deal. He jumped from the war to the hippies in one sentence, saying that beetles were insects, and didn't those long-haired foreigners know how to spell? His room was small and white, but it was clean, had a closet, a dresser, a television, and a window overlooking the town. I set his hummingbird along with his little cage on the dresser top, and then I put his clothes in a drawer. When I turned to him, he was staring out the window. Francis, lovely this time of year, he said. I wiped my eyes. I was beginning to act like Cookie. I was doing what had to be done, so why in the world was I crying? Yes, it is, I said. Uncle Fawcett grinned his toothless grin, and his eyes twinkled. You French girls are all real sexy, he said. I laughed and cried at once, only because of brave soldiers like you. He looked out the window again and then turned back to me.
Who are you? You Trudy's girl?
I nodded. That's right, Uncle Fawcett. I best be getting on my plane now.
Write me when you get home, he said.
I waved bye, and he did too. The orderly stood in the door and gave me a faint smile as I left my uncle in France, Germany, a coal mine he had worked in as a youth, or wherever he happened to be at the time. Thank you, I said. I'll call later to check on him and try to get over there 2 days a week so long as I can afford the gas. Back in my truck, I laid my head over on the steering wheel and cried for my uncle. I cried for the way he would live the rest of his days, bouncing from one memory to the next. I thought of how in the end we are all without the graceful facades that mean so much in our youth. What would Uncle Fawcett leave behind? He had outlived all of his children and some of his grandchildren. He had some great-grandchildren who lived in Cincinnati and Memphis, but he hadn't seen them in 25 or 30 years. Was he leaving a legacy? I suppose he was. He had touched my life. But whose life had I touched? I had no children. After Bob and I had been married for 5 years, he told me that he could never have kids because he'd gotten a vasectomy when he was 21 due to the fact that he witnessed that plane crash in 66 and he had been exposed to radioactive materials. What was I to do? I had spent a lot of tearful nights knowing I would never have children, but I loved Bob and he loved me. So I told him that I understood and our life together could be beautiful even without children. It's strange how a person can take comfort from things that aren't even alive. I knew there was no person in the world to comfort me. Cookie could never see me like this. Her battle with depression made me always aware of my emotional state in her presence, or at least of what I allowed her to see. And Bob, he was uncomfortable with emotion. It was too hard on his nerves. So, on the few occasions when I cried, I hid. This morning, there was no one to hide from. I was alone in my truck, the same old truck I had driven for about 13 years. My truck with its torn seats, its broken speedometer, and multitude of rusty spots. I clutched the hard plastic steering wheel like it was a dear friend as I let my tears flow right into the center of it. A loud pecking sound scared the daylights out of me. I jumped. Sheriff Ransom was pecking on my window. "Oh, crap," I said to myself, then turned my head, acting like I was putting something away. But I was really trying to dry my eyes. I did not want this guy here right now, and I didn't want him to see me crying. He pecked on my window again. "You all right in there?" I rolled the glass down. "Can I help you?" He took off his hat. Out checking on the community, you know, my job and all. Listen, I know how hard the first day of seeing someone come here can be, so, would you like a cup of coffee before you head back? There's a great little place not far from here." I stared at him. How dare this guy show up and peck on my window, then stand there fumbling with his hat like a nervous little boy? What was his deal anyway? He was some hoity-toity big shot. Why was he being nice to me? I had done nothing but shoot eye daggers at him. Well, except for the tickles I gave him. He must have seen something in my expression. He laughed. "Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't even think about it or how it must sound. I'm not asking you out or anything. Honest, I saw you here and realized that it had been a tough few days for you, so I..." "You felt sorry for me?" I asked. "No," he said. "I mean, yes, but not like that. I mean, I only want to help. Not in a legal way, but in a more human way. And, well, all I could think to say was, do you want a cup of coffee?" I stared at him. "But you're the sheriff." "I don't stop. I don't stop being human when I put on the uniform," he said. "I drink coffee. I listen to the radio. I watch television. I laugh. And sometimes I visit friends in this home." "Oh," I said. "So you were here anyway." He nodded. "Yes. So do you want a cup of coffee?"